This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Okay, everyone, welcome to the People Speak radio show. This is your host, Charles Giuliani. The website for the People Speak is thepeoplespeakradio.net. And this evening we've got a great guest. We've got Barry Zwicker. He's a Canadian filmmaker, a 9/11 truth activist exposing the inside job of 9/11. And as you've noticed, for the past several weeks now, this has been our focus, and for good reason, because once again, we are, you know, as of last Thursday, we're at the 7th year anniversary of the attacks, and yet there's more questions today than there were, you know, just a few weeks after 9/11. It should be the other way around. There were a lot of questions that had arisen, but as time went on, you would expect those questions to disappear, that the answers would have been forthcoming. But instead, more questions have arisen. And every time they give us answers, they actually give us more reason to doubt and more reason to question. So, you know, this is why we cannot stop talking about this. The real perpetrators, regardless what side of the argument you fall on, are still walking the streets, and there has not been anyone brought to justice. That even the alleged perpetrators of the attacks are still walking, particularly Bin Laden. Anyway, before I introduce our guest, let me just remind our listeners, if you want to call in, you can do so internationally by dialing in on the toll-free line 877-489-6350. Again, that's 877-489-6350. If you're in Canada or the United States, you can dial toll-free at 888-228-4494. And we welcome any comments or questions you might have for our guest. Anyway, with no further ado, let me welcome to the show Mr. Barry Zwicker. Welcome.
That's very, very good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. We appreciate all the work you've been doing, helping to bring this truth to light. And I always like to ask people I interview, you know, to give us a little background of yourself. You know, how is it that you came to understand 9/11 as an inside job? Was this something that happened after 9/11, or were you pretty much aware as it was happening that, you know, were you suspicious that it was an inside job right at the time? Or, you know, how did this come about?
Well, it's true, Charles. I happen to be one of those who twigged to the fact that it was an inside job by 11 o'clock that morning, Eastern Time. I really did, and of course I said that to people around me. My family and some tenants from our basement apartment came up, and neighbors, and I said, this is Reichstag Fire 2001. And the reason I did, I don't claim this is a great virtue, although I am proud, I think I'm proud, to have been skeptical. I was also skeptical about the Gulf of Tonkin story way back in 1964. I was a reporter at that time on Canada's national newspaper, the Globe and Mail, and there was a huge headline that these North Vietnamese torpedo boats had shot at these two American destroyers, the Maddox and the Turner Joy. And I remember, and I kept that very paper, I've still got it, that I just didn't believe it. It just seemed so fishy to me. But anyway, I think the reason, which is kind of important, why I twigged, because it's important not because I twigged, but because this probably also applies to a lot of other people, even if it's later on that they twigged. And David Ray Griffin, a huge hero to me and everybody in the 9/11 truth movement, I think it was 2003 before his suspicions were aroused, and he's done so much work since. He's really made up for lost time.
I just interviewed him last week, as a matter of fact, on this same show, yeah.
Oh, boy. And he and I were together with, along with Dave Von Kleist and others in Sudbury 2 weekends ago. But anyway, I think the reason that I was able to come to this conclusion on the very day, and I've had reason to analyze this, and it's very interesting to me. And that right just when you dialed, I'm doing an email interview with a website in Canada. They're asking me how many questions. 28 questions, and this is one of the questions too. And I think the reason is this: that first of all, my background—I was born in a manse, the son of a clergyman, a United Church minister. This is a very progressive congregation up here in Canada, the largest Protestant denomination in Canada, and very socially progressive, the Methodist social gospel and everything. My dad was always left of center, my late dad, and a wonderful guy, squadron leader in the Air Force. And so I really did grow up with a skeptical outlook and not necessarily suspicion, but an alienation from the status quo, from the establishment. I really did. And when I was about 12 years old, the Mounties, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, harassed my father. Imagine, he'd come back from the war, squadron leader, and they harassed him because already the Cold War was on, and the police are very political. So this really, you know, this is part of my background that enabled me to fully understand that governments could do dastardly things. I never grew up with a respect for authority. I wasn't, as a matter of fact, I was a behavior problem, what they call a behavior problem in school.
With the program.
Yeah. And another thing
that was before the days of Ritalin, otherwise who knows where you'd be today.
True enough. Yeah, they didn't have drugs for us then. They had the strap.
Yeah.
But anyway, then another thing was my great interest in aviation. So I joined the Royal Canadian Air Cadets, and I became a flight sergeant, and I flew a Twin Beach at cadet summer camp and everything, and I've always had this great interest in aviation. So these things came together on September 11, 2001, and when I was watching, along with millions of others, the second tower come, the second plane go in, the South Tower come down, and I was saying, "Come on, U.S. Air Force! Come on, U.S. Air Force!" That was my tone of voice, and I was really antsy about it, and I believed that America was under attack, as the crawl on the television set said. I believed it. And, obviously I said, this is war, this is an attack, and where's the U.S. Air Force? Come on, you guys, let's get going.
Any minute now, they're going to get them. Yep, any minute.
That's right. They scramble in 3 minutes. I knew all this. So I'm jumping up and down and screaming more and more. I'm screaming, come on, U.S. Air Force. So we're hearing that there's, this passenger liner's going to Washington. They're going all over Hell's Half Acre. There were reports, of more than four at the time. There may have been seven or something. And I said, this is war. Come on, U.S. Air Force. And my wife said, calm down. And after a while, I calmed down. And I said, no, this is impossible. This is impossible. The U.S. Air Force has been stood down. This is a drama in the skies that took almost 2 hours. Not a single U.S. jet interceptor turned a wheel until it was too late. That was it. I didn't need any further evidence. Now, I know, call it informed intuition or something, but I trust my instincts, and you didn't even have to have instincts in that case. It was just open and shut.
Sure.
Common sense.
Well, what I like to point out is they always say that these were master planners. Like, they totally outsmarted us. Well, if that was the case, why were they stupid enough to hijack planes up in Boston when their targets were in New York? Why didn't they hijack right in New York and slam into the targets before there was any time for an interceptor shootdown?
That's a good point. They could have taken off from JFK or LaGuardia, made one turn, and bang, they're done. And then, really, the Air Force might not have caught up with them, probably would
that's
have.
Not master planning. A half an hour of time for an intercept? It was known, according to the official story, that they were hijacked within 5 minutes after taking off. That's 25 minutes the time they had.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, or one interesting thing, Charles, there's many, many interesting things, but one interesting thing is that you're pointing this out. It makes perfect sense to me, and it's just one of, we might say at least hundreds, if not thousands, of anomalies. And any one of them would have to cast suspicion on the official story, and doesn't it blow your mind and bend you out of shape that so many people still just blindly accept the official story? Well, the thing is, they haven't looked into it. That's one thing. Another thing is, they have interests which could be harmed, interests of various kinds, which could be damaged if they allowed themselves to look into it with a truly open mind. I mean, you've got millions of people in the armed forces and work in arms factories. Got, millions of people who have government jobs, and millions of people in academia and the media who have career plans, and they don't want to rock the boat, and they want to trust their government, and they think if they don't trust their government, who can you trust? And there are all these reasons that prevent people from simply looking at evidence. And evidence should be number one, right in front of us. That's the top thing in courts. That should be the top thing in life. And yet, amazingly, many people will not look at evidence because their interests prevent them from seeing or wanting to see. And that's a huge, if you will, social, cultural, psychological, political problem that we face. But you know, the 9/11 truth movement is really, really gaining ground because a lot of people don't have huge interests. I mean, taxi drivers and poor people and people who work in supermarkets and everything, they don't have a giant connection with the establishment. You know, they don't have a career path like a professor at a college or something. And so
no axe to grind, yeah.
No, and they don't have an axe to grind. They just want to live their lives. And interestingly, it's the ordinary common people who are the most open. I found that over and over and over again.
Yeah. And, of course, the fact is that this administration has given us every reason not to trust them with all the other shenanigans they've pulled.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, and you know, it's interesting. I subscribe to 5 newspapers daily. Can you believe it? The Toronto Sun, Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, the National Post, and the New York Times. I get them every day. Well, the Globe and Mail doesn't publish on Sundays, but otherwise they're all 7 days a week.
And, you get that up in Canada, huh? New York Times? I didn't realize.
Oh, yeah. Home delivery costs a bit, but it's a deal with the Globe and Mail. The Globe and Mail and the New York Times come, you know, in a rubber band together every day. And then on Sunday, you get the Times only. But anyway, the New York Times, which, after all, is an establishment organ, but you can learn an awful lot from it. And it's almost like if you took all the stories in the New York Times about the lies that the Bush regime has perpetrated, the tricks that the CIA has pulled and so on, it is just alarming. And most people, first of all, don't read the New York Times, and secondly, the Times itself, of course, doesn't pull all these things together, or very seldom does. So that you look at the excesses of monopoly capitalism, you look at the corruption of politics and industry, you look at the toxic corruption of the arms industry, and so on. You look at the dirty tricks and the ballooning budgets, you know, black and otherwise, of the so-called intelligence community, and what you've got is sort of a collective disaster where a whole country is way off the rails. But that's what newspapers though kind of fail to do, is to step back and do that and make those kinds of observations that I've just voiced, that ordinary people can, that we're free to say, wait, we don't trust this whole picture. You know, and of course that then immediately leads you into the U.S. election and the hope for Obama and absolutely disbelief north of the border. Do you know what? North of the border, we cannot believe what is going on in your country. I can't believe it either. Honestly, it just boggles the mind. Sarah Palin. But you know, Marshall McLuhan, the wonderful communications guru, so-called, I took his course for 3 years. And you know, way back around 1968, he predicted, and someone just recollected this today and quoted him, he predicted that politics eventually would become all about image and nothing about issues. And we've arrived at the day.
Oh, yeah. That's all it is. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But those Republicans are really smart with the psychological warfare. And, you know, speaking of the New York Times, there was a great letter in the Times yesterday, yesterday was Sunday, right, somebody wrote, I have it here somewhere, I don't think I can find it quickly enough, but anyway, they quoted somebody who had in turn quoted, you know what, I found it. I'm going to read you this 2-paragraph letter to the editor. Thomas L. Friedman quotes John Maxwell, a leadership expert, as saying about Sarah Palin, quote, I think there are a lot of women out there that look at her holding her baby, talking about being a hockey mom, and say, she knows what I feel. She's going through what I am going through. The question for them is, am I ready to be Vice President of the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Signed, Donna Davis, New York. Isn't that something? Anyway, thank goodness for ordinary people. They write letters like that. They see through the veils.
I mean, they got a whole Palin line of glasses now. If you go to your eye doctor, he's got a whole section of glasses, like, you know, because everybody's requesting glasses like hers. They want the same frame.
Oh,
I mean, this is what people are caught up in. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it's clever, but I'll tell you, if the McCain ticket, Palin ticket is elected, and then anything happens to him. I mean, it's just a total nightmare. It's Alice in Wonderland, you know, on steroids. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
It really is.
Anyway, but probably you don't necessarily want to get too far into the into that. We're having a bad election.
Well, I mean, it's all connected. I mean, you know, you look at what happened today with the stock market, you know. I mean, it's this whole thing is rigged. They're ready to pull the rug out. I wonder if we're even going to have an election rigged or otherwise.
Well, you know, it's been as you probably know, Charles, in the community of what we're proud to call ourselves 9/11 truthers, for a long time now, many, many months, there's been speculation about whether the nasty people who brought us 9/11 will bring another one, another 9. I call it 9/12.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's the security card, the national security card, the terrorism card, the fear card. That's the only one they really have to play. That's the only one Republicans win on. They don't, in polls, just traditionally, they don't come out that well on the economy. God knows why would they, and or compassion or Social Security and so on. But they come out high on national defense, national security, all that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they would benefit. Newt Gingrich even mused out loud about that. They would benefit if there was another 9/11.
Yeah.
And
oh,
so
sure.
Why would they wait for Al-Qaeda to do one? Al-Qaeda didn't do the first one. Why would Al-Qaeda do the second one? What did Al-Qaeda get out of it? A whole bunch of people are killed. And that's even assuming that Al-Qaeda is a legitimate organization that wasn't originally organized.
Right.
And funded by the CIA. But anyway, I think an economic meltdown, might work, too, to
in
really
the same way.
See, what they want to do is destabilize societies. Because it's the old divide and conquer, which, were, you know, four or five tyrants agree, divide and conquer works. So the economic situation is complicating things. And but what is frightening, Noel, and, there's a guy, Jeffrey Sachs, the economist. He's the guy who actually sort of favors the shock doctrine. He said, you know, what Russia needs in Bolivia and other places is just a big shot of capitalism, private markets and everything. And I never did have much sympathy with him about that. But he did a long interview, which was published in the Globe and Mail on Saturday, and he sees that we're in a multiple crisis. We're in an environmental, you know, economic, cultural, population, technology, and probably more crisis. Yeah. And he said that the political system is just not responding. We don't have the people who are thoughtful enough, and this, I guess, he probably...
Well, McCain said today the economy is stable, it's fine.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, sure, stable. I mean, you know what? They just engage in word magic. I mean, they're so out of touch. But you know, there are probably people who want to believe that. They want to be reassured. Here's a crazy thing. People want to be scared and they want to be reassured at the same time. I mean, the human being is a rather amazing creature. I don't think we're wired for survival. You know that? I fear we're not wired for survival. First of all, so much of what we do is based on emotion. And there's nothing illegitimate about emotions in a way, just so long as you don't try to think with your heart. You have to feel with your head. I mean, the head is to think with, the heart is to feel with. You got to balance them. But mainly, people make decisions based on emotion. And that's why they go for Sarah Palin, because they like her looks, or she's a hockey mom, you know, and they're not thinking, you know, would she cause another war? Would another war be a good idea? Would it help the U.S. Treasury? Of course...
Well, you know, that's immaterial. As long as she has pretty lipstick on, if we do go to war, that's all that matters.
Yeah. And then what a dirty trick that the McCain people are twisting Obama's words when he talked about putting lipstick on a pig.
Oh, yeah, I saw that, yeah.
They tried to make out that he, Obama, was talking about
make an
Sarah.
Inference to her. Yeah.
What a
yeah.
dirty trick. I mean,
oh,
these
wrong.
Guys, there's nothing
Sweet.
They won't do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like Karl Rove is busy behind the scenes again.
I think he is. And there are other people as nasty as he is. And, of course, William Kristol was a big fan of Sarah. He saw the potential in her. And but they do more studies of psychological warfare, the Republicans do, than the Democrats ever dreamed of doing. You know, the Democrats typically have been talking about issues, you know, and as someone said, they appeal or speak on behalf of average people. What do the Republicans do? They get an average person.
Yeah, they're just far more ruthless. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're playing the religious trump card. They've got Palin talking about her evangelical background, which brings me to another point. I wanted to mention this. At the beginning of the show, you talked about your religious background and, you know, belonging to the Methodist Church or whatever? And how that's had an influence on you being skeptical. That's interesting because, as I'm sure you know, down here in the States, organized religion has served more to prevent people from being skeptical. So it looks like it's the very opposite up in Canada, huh? I didn't realize that.
Well, I'm not sure it's the very opposite, but I mean, generally, sort of as a rough, vague truism, or a rough, vague statement, that probably is essentially true. But the thing is that within religions, as you know, and David Ray Griffin is a marvelous theologian, for instance.
Yeah.
Within religions, within every religion, you have, if you will, a left and a right. Like, you've got Orthodox Jews, you've got ultra-Orthodox Jews,
sure.
You've got Reformed Jews. Within the Roman Catholic Church, you've got your liberation theology people and then your fanatical papists, you know, the Rome. And really, and the same with Methodism. You know, there's some very liberal, small-L liberal Methodists, and then others not so much. I think the Southern Baptists are kind of a lost cause, but mostly they're even the evangelicals now, you know, there's a lot of them truly understand that the environment is a spiritual question, that we are stewards of the earth, to put it in theological terms, and it's God's creation, and we should be protecting it. So quite a number of evangelicals, you have to distinguish between evangelicals and fundamentalists. Like, you get fundamentalists in every group. You get your fundamentalist communists, your fundamentalist capitalists. They just say capitalism is the answer to everything, period. And so you have fundamentalists in every group, including religion. But with religions, then there are always the religions that are more questioning, that are more open to doubt, that emphasize compassion, like the Quakers, the United Church of Canada, the Episcopalians, and the Buddhists, and so on. So that it's a big range. And as a matter of fact, church people have been really, really good on so many issues. I mean, they'd be right up there on the issue of capital punishment, for instance. And but again, you get your divisions. This is why I'm an atheist, of course. I saw early on that people who were religious, they all said they believed in God, and they ended up believing completely different things in very much life and death matters, like going into war or not. You know, like God, you know, blessing our troops. And, well, what about the other troops? If you believe in a universal God, wouldn't that God also, you know,
love everyone equally? Yeah.
Keep the other troops from harm, too? And So, when I was 15, I couldn't go on believing in God. My dad was very, very good about that. He never, you know, he understood. He said, son, you've got to follow the truth wherever it may lead. I think that's why I went into journalism, and I really, really have tried to follow that. Following the truth wherever it may lead. By the way, it's a lot easier to follow the truth wherever it may lead if you're independent. I wrote my book, Towers of Deception, and I wanted to have profiles in there of 9/11 truth people I really admire. And David Ray Griffin, actually, I wrote a whole chapter about him. But I wanted about 20 people, that would be in there, Willie Rodriguez and Carol Bouye in San Francisco and so on. So, but I wanted, I had a lot to choose from. I think I ended up with 18. But anyway, I wanted to have them as various as possible, as diverse as possible. To have female representation and also nationalities, not just Americans, but also Canadians and Brits and Germans and so on. And so I actually created an Excel spreadsheet. And I put down these 20 names, and then I produced another column. It occurred to me to do another column, which would be a job or profession. And you know what? I put down that 19 of the 20, it turned out, didn't work for any organization. Like, 19 out of 20 of these people were either retired professors, or they were freelance journalists, you know, or like that, artists, whatever. And so this, and actually the 20th person worked for a big defense corporation and was a bit questionable anyway. So so that showed me that, that people's interests or their jobs have such a huge, huge impact on what they believe. I mean, generally, you'll believe what your job or your interests lead you to believe. And that's, you know, people work for tobacco companies, you know, for years they believe, well, tobacco doesn't hurt you. So
right.
They had that belief. They would be able to turn a blind eye to evidence to the contrary. And
go with the status quo.
Yeah, cling to their beliefs. And
yeah.
But you know what? I'm coming all the way around full circle again to think that we're not wired to survive because we believe, it was Will Rogers, wasn't it, who said it isn't so much what you believe that gets you in trouble, but what you believe that ain't so. And of course, none of us, I certainly don't pretend to stand here on a pedestal and say I know everything. My God, never, never, never. I'm so aware of my ignorance in so many areas. And, I mean, all we have is little tiny, you know, pools of knowledge in a sort of a universe of ignorance. I'd like to live to be 1,000 years old from that point of view and try to learn a whole lot more. But I mean, there's one of the problems is the system we live in, which probably I would call monopoly capitalism, because it sure ain't small-time capitalism anymore.
Right, right.
Which always just edges off into corruption and crime, always.
Yep.
And imperialism and war and the worst. And so our system actually, by and large, doesn't encourage us to be our best. It doesn't encourage us to be thoughtful, to take a second look, to be fair, and to put ourselves in the other guy's shoes, and all those things that actually all the great religions ask us to do. Our system says...
You look at the animal kingdom, they seem to have more common sense than we do. We're supposed to be the most intelligent of animals, but animals are naturally not trusting, not only of humans, but other animals, you know.
Yeah.
And they'll trust you if, after a while, over a long period of time, you prove yourself trustworthy. But, you know, like my cat, I step on his paw, he's going to be very leery of me now for weeks to come. If I, you know, he sees me coming, he's going to step out of the way, you know. Ooh,
well,
I don't want to step on my foot.
I think you should, Charles, because you sound like a really mean guy going around stepping on your cat's paw. I'm with your cat, all right? You stop doing that.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, where's the general public like this? I mean, they have no survival instincts, like you said. No sense of protecting and being aware of their surroundings. And, you know, they just blindly trust and ignore the ones who are in control of their lives and let them do as they please.
Well, there's all too much truth to that. I mean, but people are propagandized and also distracted. You know, there's that wonderful book by Neil Postman, "Amusing Ourselves to Death," a really important book. And so it's not only that for instance, on really large life and death issues, war and peace issues, you know, and to some extent bread and butter issues, that the mainstream media, being part of the establishment, actually lie to us. And would, you know, repeat McCain saying everything's normal, everything's stable. But also they omit not only facts to the contrary. I'm vastly generalizing here. I mean, there are many honorable exceptions, but they omit facts to the contrary. They omit to pull together a big picture, you know, that we deserve it, and they leave out history, so the media are ahistorical, and then besides that, then they pile on disinformation and then lard it all with distraction. So, you know, people are really at a disadvantage when it comes to absorbing the media, and I mean I can't believe that I do a little thing when I give a talk called my 1 minute history of the world. And I can't do it without looking at a script. You know, it starts off where people used to be caring and sharing because it was a hunter-gatherer society, and then agricultural communities grew up, and so there could be leisure, and then the warrior class and the business class developed, and then it became oligarchies and so on, and it got worse and worse and worse and worse. And the last line is, today, with Bushosaurus Rex, like today's leaders are dinosaurs, and Bushosaurus Rex being the leading example, top TV program, American Idol. And that's the last line of my 1 minute history of the world.
Yeah, that's where we're at today. Oh, my.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I tell you what, we got to jump to a break in a couple of minutes, but
sure.
Before we do that, I've got some questions coming in via text here.
Good.
From some of our listeners. This one comes from Ms. Farat in Michigan, and she wants to know, she says, not only was there no, were there no suspects that had been caught, but no one in any area of government or security or local infrastructure or the building authorities were ever held accountable for what happened on 9/11. Why do you think that is, Mr. Zwicker, she asks.
Yeah, well, the no suspects caught, it's not precisely true, is it, because you got Massawi. And then there was a guy in Germany got tried and found guilty on a lesser charge. He apparently was some sort of with Mohammed Atta. And then you have in, well, if we're strictly speaking, 9/11 and Massawi. But the thing is that the reasons no suspects were caught was because they were patsies, they were dupes, and they couldn't really round up their own people that they tricked into playing these roles and put them on trial, because it would all fall apart if there was any honesty at all. At the Massawi trial, you know, even ABC Television News said that Massawi, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, is it Massawi?
Massawi, or, yeah.
I think it's Massawi. I'm mispronouncing
yeah.
it, sorry. But anyway, the Massawi was wearing a stun belt that actually the authorities mm-hmm. had attached this electric belt, and if he said something that was out of line, bing, he would get shocked. And mm-hmm. And apparently a reporter for ABC News actually saw this thing when Massawi was walking out. And so, could this be called a fair trial? I don't think so.
Well, they claimed that it was in case he got out of control. But how could he get out of control when they said he was mumbling, staring down at the floor, drooling on himself, basically? I mean, he was just a mush mind. You know, even the lawyer, the judge, in fact, even said, you can't believe or trust anything this man says. He keeps contradicting himself. He doesn't make sense, you know, and yet they convicted him for life.
Well, yeah, and you know what he was charged with? He was charged with not turning over information that they claimed could have enabled the U.S. government to prevent the attacks. Can you believe mm-hmm. such an Alice in Wonderland charge?
I was just going to say, the same people that have been torturing people in East European prisons, you know, the CIA
yeah.
torture chambers, and after torturing them for, you know, weeks on end, they hand them a pre-written confession and tell them, read this out loud as we record it, and we won't torture you anymore. These are the same people doing this stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We're supposed to trust
them.
Well,
we can't trust people who torture. And you know what? It really troubles me that most people don't seem to understand or try to put themselves in the shoes of somebody who gets tortured. It must be a very, very dark place to go, very, very difficult to think about. And also the media don't help. I don't think even the popular, you know, the movies and TV seem to not help in that respect, because they
right.
don't seem to look at torture from the point of view of the person being tortured. But I give full marks to Christopher Hitchens, who otherwise, you know, I got like a lot of problems with Christopher Hitchens, totally supporting the Iraq War and everything. But I give
right.
him full credit on a number of fronts. And one thing was, he underwent waterboarding. Did you know that?
I actually interviewed him. Yeah, we got to cut to a break, but we'll
sure.
pick up on that. Hold that thought,
yep.
and in a moment
okay.
we'll be right back. Stick with us, folks.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Straight from the heart. If it's not mainstream,
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's the People Speak every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern, on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit sosmorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the...
Okay, folks, we're back on the People Speak radio show. We've got, again, as our guest, Mr. Barry Zwicker, Canadian filmmaker, 9/11 truth leader in the movement. And just prior to the break, we were talking, we had to cut out there, but you had brought up an interesting point. I'm trying to remember what that was now. I usually take notes.
And you know what? I'm having trouble remembering it too, Charles.
Yeah,
are we growing
totally
old
forgot.
Together here?
Well, that's fine, because we actually have a caller.
Well, you know what? Sure, go ahead.
Oh, no, did you remember?
Well, yeah, we were talking about torture. That's
oh, that's right,
about.
Yeah. Oh, and what's his name, who volunteered to be tortured,
yeah,
that's
and,
what it was,
and,
to
and
be waterboarded,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and the thing, just to be really, really quick here before you bring on the caller, is that he had, if I remember reading the story correctly, he had arranged a signal with somebody else, and of course, this is another thing, he wasn't in a real prison, so it was just a test, and so he had a signal, he'd raise his left hand or something if it was too much, and once he got, like, into it, he was so flustered and fearful that he forgot what signal was, and that's how I recall reading the story, something like that, and so I think, you know, we could stand more talk about how horrible these tortures are and how any confession that you get under torture, you know, is not worth the paper it's written on.
Sure, sure. And, I mean, they're doing some very sadistic stuff. Waterboarding is bad enough, but when you know, the BBC did a good report on the Eastern European CIA-run torture prisons, and, I mean, they're mutilating body parts, you know, sex organs. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Oh, God.
Well, right out of Nazi Germany.
Some of these people are sick, you know. I mean, to get a job like that, to apply for it, to agree to do it, you're
sure.
Already well on the way to proving that you're a sick individual.
Well, you see, the ones who are calling the shots are sick themselves, so, you know, it's only natural they want to spread that sickness through society. They want you to be psychopaths like them, so you won't care about their corruption, but will, in fact, help participate in it.
That's right, and as soon as you do, you're part of the gang. Hitler played that very well. He Hitler never murdered anybody personally. You know, he didn't actually strangle somebody or shoot them. He didn't do that once. And but what he did was he got a lot of people to do it. And once they did it, they were compromised. They knew that everybody knew that they had murdered 100 people here or 1,000 there, and they were in. They were in for it. They couldn't turn back.
Right. I think he once said that he actually personally abhorred violence, so he didn't want any part in it directly. He just had others do it for him.
Yeah, he was a vegetarian.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, let's go to our caller, Basima in Michigan. Welcome to the show, Basima.
Thanks, Charlie. Thank you for the great work that you do, Charlie. So many people just love to hear what you have to say and what you have to offer. And Barry, thank you for speaking the truth. I wanted to ask you, Barry, Naomi Klein wrote a book called The Shock Doctrine that has a theory on what she calls disaster capitalism. In this disaster capitalism, profiteering is engineering and exploiting the profit margins of disasters. If this is true, is it not possible that we actually engineer the disasters as well, and that 9/11 is just an engineered disaster for a profit margin?
Well, Basima, absolutely. I would say absolutely yes in answer to your question. It seems very clear to me. And, you know, there's something very disappointing. I know Naomi Klein personally. I met her mother. I know her mother-in-law really well, Michelle Landsberg, former columnist for the Toronto Star, and her husband, Abby Lewis, who in turn, I know the whole family. And they've done so much good work, there's no question. But I have to be so disappointed in one respect about Naomi's book, Shock Doctrine. On page 13, she says, and she didn't have to say this, that of course she doesn't believe that the events of 9/11 were engineered or carried out as an inside job. That's what she says. I have the book here. And it is so disappointing. All she had to do was say nothing about it. I would much, much rather that she would have pointed out that 9/11 was one of the leading examples of shock doctrine. Can you think of a bigger shock that we've had lately? And she left it out of her book, Shock Doctrine.
Maybe that was the condition for publication.
I don't think so. I think it's complicated. The family, the family, which is the Landsbergs and the Lewises and the Kleins, they have a constituency. They're known as leaders of the left politically in Canada. Grandfather-in-law, David Lewis, was the leader of the Federal New Democratic Party. And that is a social democratic party, which typically, and right this day, gets about 20% of the votes in Canada. And Basima, living in Michigan, might, you know, be a bit familiar about Canadian politics. So there's this left-wing constituency, be the same kind of constituency that Michael Moore and Howard Zinn and Alexander Coburn and Noam Chomsky would have in the States. But you'll notice all those people I just mentioned are either 9/11 truth deniers, or they won't, or they're very, very, very anemic about asking any questions about 9/11. And it's the same here in Canada, north of the border. And I just figure maybe it's because they have this constituency, and somehow they have the fear, which I think is unreasonable, that if they endorse 9/11 truth or say that, sure, they think that there should be a complete, fair, international, comprehensive reinvestigation of it, that somehow they would lose some of their constituents, that it would scare them, that they wouldn't sell so many books or get so many votes or whatever. But I can absolutely attest, as a person who's been in this literally from the day of 9/11 and was the first journalist, I am proud of this, as the first journalist in the world to go on national TV anywhere and seriously question the official story of 9/11, and I started that on January the 12th, 2002, just a few months after the event. And what happened, which I did that on Vision TV, a national cable network in Canada, and what happened, I got overwhelmingly positive responses. There were 1,200 emails came in, the largest response the channel had ever had in its 15-year history, and all but a handful were positive. So you know, what are these people on the left afraid of? But anyway, now I'm ranting. But I'm really glad you brought that
good
up.
Ranting.
Well, anyway, but I'm glad you brought it up, Basima, and I think the answer to the question you've asked is just a great big yes, underlined, boldface.
Okay, was that it, Basima? Did you have any more? I think she might have hung up.
I might have talked her right out of the room.
Well, if you're listening, thanks, Basima, for the question. Very good question. Yeah, it is frustrating when you see this kind of thing. You know, it's like Noam Chomsky. I happen to like him. You know, he's written some really good books. He's exposed a lot of stuff that's been going on. But then he comes out and makes statements like, you know, not only was it not an inside job, but it's absolutely crazy to think so. Well, wait a minute. All of his writings talk about government lies to get us into war. You know, I mean, he's a proponent of false flag operations. All through his books he talks about that.
Yeah.
But now suddenly, under the most corrupt administration in American history, suddenly now, nope, that's not a possibility. Don't even consider it, especially when you look at all the problems with the official story. I mean,
I'll tell you, I think it's actually darker than that, Charles, like with Noam Chomsky. You know, in my book, Towers of Deception, Chapter 5 is called The Shame of Noam Chomsky and the Gatekeepers of the Left. 15,000 words, and it's the most popular chapter in the book. I've had more praise and thanks and gratitude expressed and additional information sent in to me since that book was published about Chapter 5 than any other chapter. And so it's not, it goes beyond a chance or mistakes or
right.
something like that. That Noam Chomsky not only will not look at 9/11 and actually severely criticizes those who have questions about it, saying that it distracts us, wastes our time. It'd be like a trick that the Pentagon thought up to waste our energies. Wow, that's very clever. But the thing is, this goes back to JFK. He never would admit that there was anything other to JFK's assassination than a lone gunman. Than it was JFK. The same with Martin Luther King. The same with Malcolm X. He is consistently through his life been a left gatekeeper. And I'm not going to say anything more except that I will say that is very, very dark. And you know, and I like the guy
right.
too. I interviewed him for TV three times. I used to have my own TV show. And I interviewed him three times. And, in fact, one day I had a rented car because I was responsible for taking him from our studio over to another studio and a nice little chat with him. And, off camera and in the car and on camera. And early on, I was one of the very earliest promoters of Noam Chomsky. Like, I taught at Ryerson University, and I used to talk about it in class, encourage students to buy his books.
Oh, wow.
A friend of mine and I had a contest going as to who could get more letters to the editor printed which responded to unfair attacks on Noam Chomsky, because, you know, he had his unfair attackers.
Yeah.
And and I've got 16 of his books. But the thing is, it started to dawn on me before 9/11 that there was something terribly wrong about his stand about JFK. And so I bought his book, Rethinking Camelot, and that was the first time my eyes really got opened, because there was dishonest stuff in there. And he claimed that Kennedy was going to carry on the Vietnam War and so on and so on.
No.
And I saw that there was logic in there that was shoddy, not at all what you would expect of Chomsky.
Well, I mean, come on, we've had E. Howard Hunt come out, David Morales have come out, two high-level CIA operatives who on their deathbed confessed that, yeah, they were involved in it, and it was a high-level CIA operation.
Well, of course. I mean, the evidence is over. Do you know there's 400 books about Kennedy? Now, the latest one, as far as I know, came out in May. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters by James Douglas. Marvelous book, by the way. He did original research, too.
Wow, haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, and there's stuff in there that I hadn't known before. You know, there was a plot to kill Kennedy in Chicago about 25...
Oh, that, yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
You heard about that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the really tantalizing things is that one of the reasons that that plot didn't succeed, and of course the Chicago police have not given out the names, they actually apprehended two of the four gunmen. They actually had rifles with scopes and everything, and they've never released their names to this day. But one of the really interesting things is that one of the reasons that they were apprehended were tips phoned in, which, you know, the police just really had to follow up. And the tipster was named Lee. And in JFK and the Unspeakable, there is a lot, well, not a lot, but an interesting amount of evidence. And James Douglas is very, very careful with his facts, that Lee Harvey Oswald began to realize that he was being used and groomed as a patsy. And that he was actually trying to get the word out that Kennedy was going to be assassinated. He was actually trying to get the word out. But I guess what he didn't realize, he must have known it was going to be done in Chicago, and they didn't tell him it was going to be done in Dallas, maybe, or something like that. We probably never know. But it's
right.
tantalizing to get some glimpse of the possible interior complexities of the dirty tricks that they play. You know, you'd wonder why people would ever agree to be patsies. I mean, because they do, to some extent, agree. Sometimes some of them are just absolutely snookered, but others, you know, they walk into it.
Yeah. Well, I think Oswald obviously thought that he was one of the inside boys and he was their buddy. I'm sure they buttered him up, you know. So he just figured, yeah, they're going to protect me no matter what happens, and probably had no idea exactly why he was told to work at the depository. He was just waiting for his next instruction. And then by the time everything played out, he realized he was set up. He even said it, you know, I'm a patsy.
He said
it was too late then, yeah.
That's right. It was sort of need to know, and they said, well, go up there. We've got a reason for you to be there. But he actually, there's a lot of evidence that he liked Kennedy. Oswald personally liked Kennedy, kind of identified with him, and generally liked his politics.
Well, his six-foot-tall double didn't.
No.
You know, those stories about the shooting range, and you know, I'm going to get that blankety-blank, and, you know.
Yeah.
They couldn't get one that was at least the same height. I mean, he was obviously not him, you know, like 6 feet tall, this guy that one of the witnesses described seeing.
Boy.
That it looked just like him, but he was...
Oh, God.
It's just unbelievable. It's like the new Bin Laden they have, you know, confessing to 9/11. He's got a long, a short, stubby nose instead of a long, slender one, and he's now left-handed instead of right-handed. And,
yeah,
or vice,
and all
vice
that
versa.
Stuff. And in one of them, his beard got less gray when
I know it, yeah.
The videotape came out later. He has a darker beard. I wish that happened to my beard.
Well, I hear bat dung makes a great hair dye, so maybe, yeah. That's nonsense. Anyway, time's really rushing away. I want to get to some more questions here before time runs out on us. Actually, I have a question for you first, and then we'll go into some of these other ones that are coming in. I was just wondering how you feel about the possibility of... corrupt elements within the Israeli government, particularly the Mossad, playing a role in 9/11. Do you see any evidence for that? Or
I fear that you'd have to be very naive to think that the Mossad wouldn't be interested in this. Considering the overall geopolitical situation in the world, where the United States has been the chief backer and funder and armor of Israel all along, so, I mean, nobody can deny that. And, you know, even Noam Chomsky, let's quote him, you know, says Israel is the outpost in the Middle East. And the worst elements of Israeli society, you know, ultra-Zionists and so on, they're fanatically fanatical believers. They're fundamentalists. We were talking way back about fundamentalists. And they can only see things one way. They got a, you know, narrow vision. And although many, many, many people in Israeli society, I know quite a few of them, they're heartsick about various things, and they realize there needs to be an accommodation, and there's a lot in the Talmud about making friends of your enemies and so on. But anyway, so much for religion. It plays both ways. But, but the Mossad is a very, very powerful and effective organization. They've had a lot of successes. You know, they did that thing at Entebbe in Africa. They successfully got that plane that was being held hostage. But they've also played a lot of dirty tricks, Mossad has, and Bin Shet has also. Have I got that right? There's another Israeli intelligence organization, Shin Bet. I think it's Shin Bet. And that's one that, you know, they had an Israeli airliner shot down back in the 70s and blamed it on the Palestinians. The Achille Lauro incident was absolutely done by Mossad.
USS Liberty, the Levant affair.
The Levant affair, USS Liberty. So they have a track record of being involved in false flag operations and deceit. I mean, there are a couple of really excellent books written by a guy named Victor Ostrovsky, and he happens to be Canadian-born, went to Israel and was recruited to the Mossad, and he wrote a book called By Way of Deception, and the second book, The Other Side of Deception, and he reveals a lot. I think he's authentic. I'm 99% sure he is.
Yeah.
It's very hard to tell with so-called intelligence people, because most of them are still on the payroll, and they're just working in a different way, but I think he's probably legit. And he tells about these dirty tricks that Mossad does all over the world, including the USA. And he was in Italy, Denmark, Germany, those are countries I remember, and Canada. And so I think that Mossad would have had a great interest in seeing 9/11 happen. When you ask this super important question, who benefits? The worst elements of Israeli society benefited.
Well, I mean, you look at the pages of Haaretz and Jerusalem Post. They even admit that, you know, the Israeli government has been at the helm of pushing us into Iraq, and now this push into Iran comes from them as well. I mean, their own newspapers attest to that. Yeah,
that's right. Of course, and Netanyahu is a real menace, and of course, I think that if she hasn't already become the prime minister, this Livni Tipsit, or Tipsy Livnet, or whatever her name is, she comes from Mossad. She was in Mossad.
Herself, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and her grandfather was a member of the original Irgun gang, you know? They were terrorists. It's been recognized they were terrorists back in 1948.
Yeah.
Her grandfather was a leader in that. So
that
anyway,
was probably Menachem Begin's group there, right? He had founded that, I believe.
I think so. So anyway, you know, and none of this, as you well know, Charles, is in the tiniest respect anti-Semitic. It's got zero
sure,
to do
of course.
With anti-Semitism.
It's just their propaganda.
And anybody who tries to lay that on me or you or anybody, they're really going
any more than protesting Hitler's Nazi regime was anti-Aryan or anti-German. I mean, that's how ridiculous that whole thing is.
A good parallel. I never heard that parallel before, but it's very good, very good parallel.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, I fear that Mossad was actually involved, and it would only be a question of the extent. And, you know, we have the fact, it is a fact, it's a proven fact, it's documented, that you had those Israelis who were doing high fives there over New Jersey,
sure.
And that they were actually picked up by the New Jersey police, and Alex Jones interviewed the police chief, who tried to wriggle around and explain why they let them go without charges and didn't
keep
their names.
Sure.
You know? So the corruption is very widespread. The cover-up is very widespread. I think that that we have to deal with this. It's something that we can't stay away from because we're afraid of being smeared with the charge of anti-Semitism.
Right,
and
that's got to stop. It's like the boy who cried wolf. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, enough of that. So that's my answer to your question.
Right. And of course, we have the Carl Cameron report, where he said evidence linking these Israelis, those dancing Israelis, with the 9/11 attacks was classified, and we cannot comment on it. So that ends it right there. There is evidence, they just can't talk about it.
Yeah. By the way, there was another thing that that's vaguely related to this, of course, which was the news that went out within 24 hours of the events of 9/11, that 3,000 Jews didn't show up for work in the World Trade Center.
Oh yeah, to go
And I recognized that the instant I heard it as CIA disinformation, a very
dirty
trick.
So, right.
And people who should have known better started to repeat it. Said, "Don't repeat that. That's
right.
BS." You know, and of course the people who would benefit from it keep quoting that other people quoted it. And but I mean, whoever in the CIA thought that one up probably got a raise.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's see. I'll just take one more question here, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. This comes from Mike in California. Yeah, he was just wondering, do you believe that the London bombings were also a conspiracy of, you know, 7/7/05?
Yeah, I sure do. It happened by coincidence that on July the 7th, 2007, London 7/7, no, it was 2005, wasn't it?
2005, right.
Yeah. On that day, I was in London, but I was in London, Ontario. You know? And it's like there's probably a place named Paris in Arkansas or something. Anyway, I was in London, Ontario, and I was going to go on a radio program at 11 o'clock in the morning. So I thought, well, I'll listen to this station because I was staying overnight with friends. So I thought, I got up at 8 o'clock, had breakfast. So I was listening to the station and getting a feeling for the hosts and all that. And that's when the news came across of these bombings, which I guess had happened. There's an 8-hour time difference. So, or at least it was all over the news that morning, whenever it happened. And so I thought, holy mackerel, this sounds fishy to me. Once again, I wasn't sure, but I was pretty sure. Sounded fishy. So at 11 o'clock, I go on. I was to be on there for, I think, for 30 minutes. And, of course, the hosts said, look, you know, you're in town to speak about, you're to show your screening down at the public library, and these people are sponsoring the meeting and everything, and so we want to talk about that. But before we do, what do you think about these bombings in London? And I said, you know what, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say this is another false flag operation,
mm-hmm.
that this just really smells, and bang, there's sort of this silence, and then the producer comes on, and he says, sorry, Mr. Zwicker, he said, our station has gone off the air. And he said, I'll get back to you. And so then, and I could, because I had the station on in very low volume in the background. And then I realized, no, you know, it stopped. And so then the producer came back on and he said, you know what, we've just lost our total signal. The station's off the air. I said, how often does this happen? He says, never.
Well, there
anyway,
you go.
The station did come back on in about 15 minutes, and they called me back, and they finished the interview. They bounced the other guests. And,
wow.
But anyway, it was, you know, I mean, if, for Mike in California, I mean, this is a softball question.
The evidence
about the London bombings is so, as a matter of fact, MI6, they are such tricksters. Before the CIA were tricksters, you know, MI5, MI6 have been into this deceptive.
Sure, their fingerprints are all over that.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know what, unfortunately, I wish we had more time, but we've actually run out. But yeah, just, you know, Google that, MI6 involvement in 7/7 bombings, and you'll see plenty of evidence for that.
Yeah.
It's just overwhelming. Anyway, I want to thank you for coming on. Real quick, any website you want to plug? Or?
Well, no, you know, my website is so cobwebby, but I will take advantage, since you've asked me, that people can order my book directly by calling my home telephone number, and I'll give it to you. It's area
sure.
code 416, and the number is 651-5588. 416-651-5588. And I just love to sell the books directly from the author.
Excellent.
And I have a good price plus postage and handling, and I autograph it, and I get to know people. And
okay.
I like to do it.
Hate to cut you off there. Sorry, Barry, but we've really run out of time. Thanks
sure
a lot
thing,
for coming
Charles.
On. Really appreciate it. And keep up the great work.
Thank you, and you do too.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, folks. Tomorrow night we're going to have a repeat of repeat broadcast of Joseph Lentini of the USS Liberty Veterans Association. That interview will be rebroadcast tomorrow night. Next week I'll be interviewing Ernie Gallo, president of the USS Liberty Association. You don't want to miss that. It'll be a very interesting and revealing interview. So until then, have a great evening. Take care, folks.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow.